As you know, the names that that people gave to their children in the Torah were different than the names than the whole concept. The whole concept of giving a name was different in the time of the Torah than it is today. How is it different? It appears that the name that a parent decided to give to the child was something of great importance. It wasn't just at random. Usually it signified some concept. You see, in the case of Yitzchak, the name Yitzchak signified an idea. It was a serial killer. I don't think that it was, you know, but that's the idea. It's like a family kind of thing. Or else they usually think that's why they have two names. Because the name that they have to name after, they may not like the name. Right? So then they'll put on another name where it's to balance it off, to counterbalance it with something which sounds pleasant, or it's a name which they like. But they like it not necessarily for the right reasons. Now, according to the Torah, the name is a very important, does have an important significance. Why is that? Well, you see, it's a good vehicle for... It's not always prophecy. The reason for it is like this. It's because, see, it is important to choose a name with care. Even, I know many cases where people wanted to give their child a certain name, and it may have sounded funny. And they said, you should do that because it's going to make the child feel bad because he's got a funny family name and people are going to maybe laugh at him or whatever. And they make him feel bad. So you have to consider that. But the name, see, a person's name has a certain significance to them. Right? You see that whatever your name is has a special significance. If somebody else has, I have the same name, or somebody famous. If somebody's famous or important, and your name goes to that person, or it just happens to have your name, you already have a certain identification. Somebody should become a famous movie star named Ronit. So, it has a certain... you'll have a certain interest in following the career. For no other reason than it happens to be your name. Okay? Stephen Renee is not here to pick on, so... you're the substitute. Okay? Now... Therefore, the point is then that if the names that they gave in the Torah signify certain important ideas in the life of the parents, which are universal ideas about God and how God relates to man, now, therefore, that idea is more likely to have an impact on the child because that's his name, so he's curious about his name and wants to know the significance. So therefore, by giving him that name, and then when he grows up, he learns the idea behind that name, so he'll be more attached to the idea. So there's a reason. That's why this matter should be approached with seriousness. When you name a child, I think even if you're going to name them after somebody, that person should represent something. And if you're going to not name them after somebody, then it should be the name that you pick should have a certain idea or concept or relevance that's significant, so that when the child grows older, the child will want to know, naturally, who am I named after? Why did you give me that name? Then you'll explain the concept. Now, it doesn't guarantee anything, but there's a greater likelihood that idea will have a bigger impact upon the person just because that's his name. You see? And the name of a person is very important to them psychologically. Now, if that's the case, let's take a look at the names that Moshe gave to his two sons. I want to analyze that today. Alright, as you know, we've been doing the story of Moshe, his relationship to Yisro. This is in chapter 2 now, Pasuk Beis, which is 22. 22. 222 Shemot. So it says that she bore a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, Gera Yisi Be'eretz Nachriya, I was a stranger in a foreign land. So that was the name that Moshe gave his first child. Now if you turn to Yisro, Pashas Yisro, which is chapter 18, I believe. Yep, chapter 18. This is the story of Yisro's reunion with Moshe. We took it up last week. It says that Yisro took Tzipora when he rejoined Moshe. At this point, Tzipora and the children, the two sons, were with Yisro, the wife of Moshe, after he had sent her away, and her two sons, the name of one of whom was Gershom. And it repeats again, he repeats the reason, for he said, I was a stranger in a foreign land. So of course one question could be, why does the Torah have to repeat Gershom? We already know about Gershom. Of course you can answer, because since it's introducing us now to the other one. And the name of the second was Eliezer, Kielokei Avi Be'ezri, for the God of my father was assisted me, by Yafileini Mecher Paro, and he saved me from the sword of Paro. So this is the two names. This is the two names. And the reasons for each are given. And basically these are all the facts that I have for today's shiur. I want to analyze it. But we start always with problems. What's problematical over here? But the names, a significant thing seems to be how God relates to man. The relationship, what God, the role of God in our life. That seems to be the most important idea of all. It doesn't have to be. I would say also the name usually to signify something, a general, universal idea. I mean, you can't, something which is very, you know, an aspiration or something like that. It can't be some advanced, abstract kind of thought. I mean, it's not going to... On the miracle. On the miracle. Yeah, it is. That is true. An incident... Well, it does. It's something which God did. It's something which God did for Abraham and Sarah. The whole miracle was for them. As a result of that miracle, he came into existence.
Yeah, but it relates to the child.
It relates to the child. Okay, your question, I hear your question. David's question is that the name seems to commemorate something which happened for Moshe Rabbeinu. The answer to that question is that it's true, but that which occurred to Moshe is based upon a certain universal idea which applies to everybody. In other words, Moshe... Well, what's that? We're talking about Eliezer. We're talking about Eliezer. The event that Moshe is talking about, the fact that he was saved by God, represents a universal idea. He's commemorating it through his own experience. He experienced, but what he experienced is something which relates to everybody. So that makes sense. Now, I would just answer worries that the name Eliezer, I think, is very significant. The fact of the matter is, it connotes very important ideas. That Moshe Rabbeinu risked his life, and he did an act of justice courageously, and he slew the Egyptian, and for that, because of that, Pharaoh wanted to kill him, and God saved him. So the idea that God intervenes for the tzaddik, that God governs the world, and God is concerned about the tzaddik, and God goes so far as to save him from a situation of total disaster, that name, I think, is very important. I have no problem with that. Yes, Jackie? Gera Yisibere Safri is not referring to Mitzrayim, obviously, you know that. He's referring to his Midian, to his stay in Midian. That's the shot. That's fact. He's not referring to his sojourn in Mitzrayim. Nope. No, for because if that's the case, first of all, he was there less than the others. The Jews were there longer than him. It's clearly referring to Midian. I'll tell you what bothers me. First of all, I don't think the implication is that he's thankful, I was a stranger and now I'm not. I don't believe that. Because of a number of reasons. First of all, at the point in which he gave the name, he was still a stranger in a foreign land. So what's the Hayishi? You could ask that question, it's not in the past tense. This is why he's still in Midian. So that itself doesn't make sense, because the name should have been Ger Ani. Right, I am. He didn't know. Again, this is prior to the revelation by the snack. When God tells him, at this point he's not going back to Mitzrayim. He has no idea. He has no idea if he's going back to Mitzrayim at this point. So why would he even say Hayiti? That's an even stronger question. He's still in that state. It should be in the present tense. But I'll tell you what bothers me about that name. What bothers me about that name, I'm taking it differently. I'm not taking it that he's praising God for having extricated him from being a gift. So your question is valid. There's something that's much more bothersome about it, Mindy. The question is, the way it should be presented, is that it doesn't state, it just states a fact. What's the idea behind it? Here are you, see, the error's not clear. I was a stranger in a foreign land. Where's the idea? It's just a fact. Now, we're assuming that the name that they give, or the fact that they state, is representative of some concept. Now, Elokei Eliezer is an idea. Elokei Eliezer, there's an idea over there. And Vayatulei Necher Paro. But there's an idea. Hashkacha. But there's no idea. This is just a fact. I was just saying, for a minute. So what? Now, they didn't establish things by association with extraneous events like the Indians do, like if someone was born during a tremendous storm, you know, when they, you know, big storm brewing or whatever. I mean, yeah, white fire. That means that's just an accidental relationship. This seems to be, on the surface, just a historical fact. Where's the idea here? Where's the concept? That's my first question. The other question is the ordering of the two. We don't understand yet. We have two problems here. First of all, we don't understand what's the significance of Gershon. But certainly we do understand the significance of Eliezer. That's a very important thing. That's a major... There wouldn't have been a Gershon if you wouldn't have had the Eliezer, or Avi Be'ezri. So wouldn't you think that he would name the first child Eliezer? Because that's already signifying a miracle. That's a miraculous phenomenon. It's recognition of God. And at the time that he had, let's say you have a few different possibilities for names. Now the first child will get the most significant one, should get the most significant one. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't have another child. So certainly at that point in time, Eliezer should be the first. Then whatever Gershom signifies, which we don't know what it is yet, but we can assume that Eliezer came first. That preceded. The first child should have been Eliezer. The second one should have been Gershom. So I have two questions here. First of all, what is the name of Gershom? At all. Secondly, I'd like to know why Gershom comes before Eliezer. That would imply that it's more significant. That it has a greater significance. Questions? I want questions. You're not addressing yourself to this thing. Even Laurie, what you're saying is that he's saying, Gera Yisi, I was a stranger. I don't now, I'm not. But he still is a stranger in a foreign land. Because at the time he named the child, he was still in Midyar. No one has really addressed themselves to that. Also... Okay, we'll try and explain it. What happened? It doesn't seem like such a tremendous exile. On the surface, it does not seem to be such a tremendous exile. As Moshe is making a big thing out of it. But on the surface, if you read the Pesukim, it doesn't seem like it's a big deal. Because it says, it's in Shmos Beis, in chapter 2, 15. So Paro heard about it, and he sought to kill Moshe, and Moshe ran away from Paro, and he dwelled in the land of Midian, and he dwelled by the Be'er, by the well. And then the Kohen made a Tisra, had 7 daughters, and then the story of how they came to water the sheep, and you know the story with the shepherd, which I went over last week. And immediately, then they come to home, and Yisro finds out and tells him to bring Moshe in. He brings him in. Moshe agrees to live with the man, and he gives him his daughter Tzipporah. So the whole thing seems to happen very, very quickly. So what was this? I was a stranger. Like, how long is he a stranger in a foreign land? It's like a very short period. It would seem to be a very short period of time. It doesn't seem to be such a major thing. Well, then he was in Egypt too. But he's not referring to Egypt. He's referring to this land. Now, let me begin my analysis. What's the name itself? Gera Yisi Be'eretz Nachriya. What's difficult about that formulation? I was a stranger in a foreign land. Let's analyze the statement itself. What's difficult about the statement itself? No, I have to put my questions on the statement. But what is difficult about that statement? Just take that statement. Exactly. It's a redundancy. It seems to be a redundancy, because what is a ger? Ger is a stranger. So therefore, a ger is an individual who finds himself in a foreign land. So what's the idea of a stranger in a foreign land? The statement itself is redundant. That's the first.
If
you're
foreign, if you're foreign
on a
foreign land, then you're
a foreigner. Yeah, I mean, that's right. It doesn't make any sense. I will try to explain why it's restated. I'll try and answer all these questions. But the approach is, I think, in the term itself. Apparently, there is such a thing, there's a stranger. And then there's another, there's two kinds of strangers, apparently. There's a stranger, and then there's a stranger in a foreign land. Now, try and elucidate the two. Well, the way to do so is to look for an example of another stranger, another individual whom we've encountered who is a stranger, but of whom we would not say he was a stranger in a foreign land. And he comes to mind immediately. Because God told him, lech lecha. So that's the idea of a stranger, one who uproots himself from his familiar environment, from his homeland, from his family, right, from his birthplace, and he goes into a strange land. So Avram was a stranger. But would you say that the experience of Avraham was the same as the experience of Moshe? Why not? What's the difference? So what's Eretz Nachriya? A strange land, as opposed to... In other words, the Avram was a ger, but ger v'tosho. That's the expression. I am a stranger and a sojourner. What does that mean, a stranger and a sojourner? It's an interesting contradictory formulation. It means, well, we have forgotten the ger part. We're talking about tosho. But Avraham, even though he was a stranger, but the area that he found himself in was not Eretz Nachriya, was not totally strange to him. Which means that he found a society in that area to which he could attach himself. He found people who were willing to listen to him. In fact, he continued his work by Yitzhak Hashem and Hashem. So even though it wasn't his own place, and he didn't feel totally comfortable, he still had to remain apart, he was there, but it wasn't Eretz Nachriya. It wasn't a foreign land. It meant to say that he could function, he could do his life's work, he could continue. Now the greatest proof of this is the way people related to him on the death of Sarah. When he says, Ger v'soshav anochi imachem. Which is, by the way, that's the model of how a Jew should act in Gola, is Ger v'soshav. And they get the greatest respect from the Gentiles. He retained the status of Ger, which means he was a Ger, he was different. When it came to questions of how he lives his life, his whole philosophy of life, he was different. Because everybody's following the instinctual, the materialistic. He was different. He was following the true ideals. But he was a tosho, which means to say that he didn't lock himself up into a ghetto and simply turn his back on the society, like he's better than they are, like he doesn't care about them. When it came to matters of civic concern, of social, of mutual concern, he was a tosho. See? And that's their respect. See, that's a very big taina, a very big complaint that the Gentiles have against the Jews, that they feel themselves different, they live in our land, they get the benefits, but then they're just for themselves. They separate themselves. They don't concern themselves. As recently as last year, you know, I'd walked from Far Rockaway into Inwood, where my school was on Shabbos, and as you come into Inwood, the yellow ribbon, the flag, and we go, forth, flag. Coming to Far Rockaway, you know, occasional flag, that's a very big thing. In other words, the Jews enjoy the benefit of the land. When it comes to a demonstration of patriotism, forget it. So, he was a tosho. Now, what did they call him? They said, Nesi Elohim Atah B'Tochenu. They had the greatest respect for him. You're a prince of God amongst us. B'Tochenu, amongst us. B'Mifra Tvarenu. They had nothing but the greatest respect. They wouldn't even take money. Okay, unconsciously he wanted money, but at least on the surface, the idea, to them, the idea of taking money. That shows that they had tremendous respect. Now, what about Moshe? What does it mean he was a ger? It means he had a different experience. Not only was he a ger, was he uprooted from his familiar environment, but the land that he found himself in was one which was totally inhospitable to his ideas. The people over there did not welcome him. We don't see too much of it. We see the shepherd, he opposes them. But Moshe did not get involved. He was not part of any society up there. That was a strange land. Well, Yisro was that one. Okay, Yisro was the exception to the rule, but he didn't. There was no society. He was exactly. Yisro was an outcast. That's why the shepherds drove them off, because they were outcasts. They were excommunicated because they weren't idolaters. It would be, for example, let's think in modern terms. What would you, for example, let's say you were exiled. You're kicked out of the United States. That's what we would consider exile. Okay, because this has become our homeland. Let's say you're kicked out of the United States. So if you're exiled. I'm not going to use Israel as an example because that wouldn't be a correct example. Well, yeah. All right. I hate that. No, but I'm giving an example. Let's say you were in Europe, a pleasant European country, whatever, Belgium or even England. You would not, you'd feel that you're a stranger, but you wouldn't feel like in a foreign land because even there you'd find people that you can relate to. And there's a Jewish community, even if it wasn't a Jewish community. But you'd find Westerners. You'd be able to share some certain Western concepts. You talk about democracy, you talk about other things, general philosophy. You wouldn't, but of course, if you were to be classical and exiled to a place like Iraq, yeah, well, even Japan has become Westernized. Even Japan, you can get by. It's become Western. I mean to say, if you find yourself in one of these African countries, or you find yourself in Libya, or in a country like that, you would, that's Eretz Nachria. That's totally different. Alright. Now, still in all, my question remains. So what? So what? It's still a fact. So Moshe's exile, Moshe's Gerus, is being a stranger, was completely different than that of Abraham. But the question still remains, the name just signifies a fact. What's the concept behind the name? I'd like to elucidate that more. See, if we read the Torah superficially, it appears that all of these events happened in quick succession. Moshe left the country, he dwelled by the bear, he saw the girls, and then he saved them, then Yisro takes them in, then he marries, and he has a child, then the burning bush, then he's back to Egypt. So then the whole thing doesn't seem very significant. If you read the story superficially, the whole thing does not seem to be significant. Moshe's not going to name his child after an event which didn't even last that long. However, there's a very significant Ramban. And the Ramban says, take a look on Chaf Gimel, 23, chapter 223, Shemot. It says, it was during those many days, those many, many days, and the king of Egypt died. And the Jews cried out to God because of the work. And their cry went up to God because of their work. Now the Ramban says that this is a reference to the long period of time. The long period of time in which Moshe spent in Midian. In other words, between the time he arrived, it says that he ran away from Pharaoh, he went to the land of Midian, and by Yeshev, and he dwelled by the Be'er. Between that pasuk and the next one, which is 16, the story about the daughters of Yisro and the intervention to save them, oh, many, many years take place, go by. How many years? Well, he quotes Chazal. How old was Moshe? It says Moshe grew up and he went out amongst his brethren and he saw the Egyptians. How old was Moshe at that time? Chazal say about 12 years old. A teenager, about 12. It says there's different. I'm sorry. Take a look at Ramban closer. I'll quote it to you directly. But he says like this. That he says, when it says that Moshe grew up and he went out amongst his brothers, he says that happened as soon as he grew up. And he was able to think. His mind matured. And they told him that he was a Jew. And he desired to see the situation of his brothers and their travail and their oppression. And the day that he went out, he slew the Egyptians. On the second day, they snitched on him, and he ran away. V'hinei hoya k'ben shtei mesrei shana. He was approximately at that time 12 years old. Although Moshe was precocious. I mean, he was the greatest, this shouldn't surprise us, but at 12 years old he was capable of this. He was precocious. He was the greatest man that ever lived. He was about 12. as the Chazal say, he quotes Chazal. He says, and there must be, I'll call upon him, he says, at the very most, he had not reached the age of 20. All right, so therefore, most probably 12, no older than 20. Now we can figure out how many years transpired, because when he returned, he was 80 years old when he returned to Paro. We know that because Moshe lived 120 years. And from the time of the Exodus to the time of his death was 40 years. So therefore Moshe returned at the age of 80. Now if he left at the age of 12, and he says that all the events of that event with the daughter and the getting married, that took place at the end of his stay in Midian, at the end of his stay. That happens, in other words, when the Torah picks up the story with the shepherds and the marriage and the child and the snap, it's all at the same period of time. So therefore, if you assume 12 years old, and we know he came back at 80, that would mean that a period of 68 years transpired between the time he escaped and between the time he encountered Israel. 68 years. 12 when he got to Midian. Not older than 20. I'll stick with 12. Okay, Brian? He got married then when he was about 80. Or at the end of that period, when he was 80 years old. Let me just put this up. You know, during the period from the time that he left, at about 12 years old until he married, about 68 years, he's involved in learning by day and by night and perfecting himself. When he left Mitzrayim, he was on the lower levels, the preliminary levels of Nevuah. So he wasn't actually a Navi. He had the help of God, Ruach HaKadosh, the Holy Spirit, as we say. Two proofs. First of all, you see that he didn't get married until the end. Now, why didn't he get married before this point? Is it just because Yisro decided to give him Kippurah and Moshe was totally passive? The answer is he didn't get married because he was preoccupied with his development, with studying by day and by night. The second proof that he was engaged in studying, in perfecting himself, was the fact that at this point he now receives the Nevuah of the burning bush, which he did not receive before this. And this means that he still had not received the highest level of Nevuah. That was to come a bit later, but he was already on the upper rung, close to the top level, the highest levels of Nevuah. And God entrusts him with the mission to take out the Jews and to be their leader and to be the one to give them the Torah. So already at this point he has achieved just about all of the perfections that singled him out as the greatest Nevi who ever lived. So he had gone from a great level, of course, in Ephraim, but to a qualitatively different level. A qualitatively different level during those 68 years. All right? Yeah. Well, Lori, let me share the point. Lori had a point. The thing is like this. What does this have to do with Gershom? Now, I mentioned that Moshe did not get married until the end of the series. So you see that when this occurs, he's come to a certain significant point in his development. Now, why would he refrain from getting married during the time that he was involved in money? Why would he refrain from getting married? What's the problem? Yeah? Yeah. See, in other words, in order for a person to... That's a possibility. But I would say this, there's more to it than that. Because in order for a person to achieve a high level of metaphysical perfection, he requires freedom. He requires a certain amount of freedom from distraction. Now everybody has to confront distractions. Distractions are just part of, by the very fact of your physical being, you have to exist in the world, you can have distractions. You have to obtain your necessities. We're not living in Gan Eden. If you live in Gan Eden, I guess even there were certain distractions, but they were minimal. But there are two types of distractions. A very important point. There are two types of distraction that a person confronts. What are the two kinds of distractions? One distraction is like of an impersonal nature. Right? It's impersonal. It's simply acquiring the necessities. If you're involved in a confrontation with the external world, that's one type of distraction. That, I say, is not the biggest problem. Even Moshe Rabbeinu in Midian had to contend with that. He lived. It wasn't like 40 days and 40 nights with God where there was no distraction. He didn't have to eat. He still had to eat. He had to take care of himself. He had certain things he had to do. Maybe he had to pay taxes, I don't know. But what's the other category of distraction? The social. The social. The social is by far the biggest threat to a person's perfection. See, man by nature is a social animal. Now, I'll say, why is the social more of a problem? For two reasons. Because, see, when you're dealing with an object, no matter how bad it is, if this breaks down, that breaks down, there's a figure break, it has to be fixed. But it's not an emotional drain. When you have a friend, when you have an obligation to another person, it's a different kind of a thing. It's another human being. It's more complicated to deal. You have to deal with the person. Of course, we're involved in this because we want certain things. We get certain sustenance, emotional. Yeah, but you have to give as well. And it's problematic because the person's emotional needs are much greater. And it has a greater effect on your emotions. That's one thing. So therefore, that's why you didn't get married. But there's another element in the social. There's another element in the social which poses a potential threat to the philosopher. The obligation is one. I'm saying the nature of the obligation. Besides the obligation, is the distraction, the input, the influence. In other words, man, by nature, is tremendously affected by the social reality. In other words, the idea that what other people think must be true, that association. That is the most significant thing. Most, for example, what's so great about the discovery of Abraham, Avinu, aside from the intellectual breakthrough, he discovered the true idea of monotheism. What's even greater is the fact that he did so in a society which was totally idolatrous, that he was able to perfect himself, to separate himself, that the world of true and false. He lived in the abstract world of true and false and was not affected by the opinions of mankind. That's a different kind of separation from the social. This is the great danger that we face. That's the whole idea of the Golus, and that's the whole idea of Israel. When the Torah tells us that we can never achieve the level, as a society, the level of perfection in Golus, in Chutzlar, no matter how good the situation is, we can never achieve the same level as the as we can in Eretz Yisrael. Perfection for the Jewish people is possible only in Eretz Yisrael. Because no matter what the situation is, you're going to be affected by the social reality of the given society. There's always a certain extent. Now, the great pioneers in history, and that's why we answer with Elokei Avraham, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, but we answer with Elokei Avraham, God of Avraham. It doesn't mean that Avraham was the greatest, reached the highest level intellectually of the Avos. They say that Yaakov even was Bechir Sheba Avos, Yaakov. But Avraham possessed a quality that the others didn't necessarily possess. And that is the ability to make that discovery in the face of a world that's thought completely differently. Now, see, for most people... Yeah, well, of course, we have to partake. Oh, of course. That's the essence of Ivri. That's the idea of Ivri. Kol olam b'Ivri echad, v'yavam b'Ivri achad. That is to say that when it comes to true and false, we're not affected by what people think, but we live in the world of reality, of true ideas. Now, every Jew and the Jewish people, in order to survive, has to have that ability to be an Ivri, to separate yourself from society. But some people can only do so to a limited extent. We're affected by it in America today, where the Jewish people have become very from, but they've been affected by the values of the Gentile world. So they have an interesting combination of the two. I mean, you can be ritualistically from, but philosophically you can be completely assimilated. And without even realizing what you hold to be important, the values, like the idea today, for example, that an average Jewish parent has about college. And that they can't credit if their kid doesn't go to college. It could have absolutely no relevance to getting a job or anything. It's like he's defective. He doesn't have his BA or his MA. No matter what he's going to be doing. Because the statistics show that it's less and less relevant given today's economy. That's what we get to society. That's one example. But most people would look at the situation that Moshe was in as a great tragedy. Because most people can't contemplate the idea of being alone. That's why loneliness is one of the worst problems in psychologists. One of the biggest themes amongst the psychologists is loneliness. So they try and tell you that, you know, well, today because it's a big tragedy. If a person isn't married, if a person is alone, loses a spouse, loneliness is regarded as the worst possible tragedy. And then they try and tell you that, no, it really isn't so bad because you can discover yourself, whatever. These solutions.
Right.
I know they're right, but these solutions don't help. Because that's not what the person's looking for. Because the person by nature, that's his whole essence, is to be a social being. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu was totally different. He experienced total isolation. That's Ger HaYisi, B'Eretz Nachriya. It was a greater isolation even than Avraham Avinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu, what do you mean HaYisi? He still was. No. HaYisi. He went through a period of a transformation. It was a time period. He was referring to that process of development that he had gone through. He wasn't referring to the chronological time that he spent, because in that sense, he still was a Ger. He meant that he had gone through a complete transformation, and he had reached the highest possible level in terms of recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that the ability to be totally separated and free from society, to a person like Moshe Rabbeinu, that was the greatest blessing. Because for him, he didn't partake of the social reality at all. He was totally involved in one reality, the metaphysical reality. The reality of the world of perceiving the ideas of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You'll see another proof, by the way. The greater the individual is metaphysically, as a person progresses, he becomes less sociable. Less involved in the social. In other words, the less developed the person is metaphysically, the more he's involved in the social. See, when a person is not involved in the world of ideas, then the only world he can relate to is the world of the social. See, that's why most people went outside. That's their whole life, is their social life. Their calendars are filled, and they get tremendous anxiety that the weekend is coming and they don't have it filled in. Especially when people are single, then it's a tragedy. But even married people, whatever, they've got that. What's doing for the weekend? Who are we going to be going out with? Who are we going to see each other with? These people go. That people being in, being part of a social group. And if they're not into a social group, then it's a tremendous anxiety, tremendous tragedy. But the greater a person is metaphysically, the less he's involved in this. You see this in Bereshit. For example, Yaakov Avinu. You see that, well, we know who's the most in our framework, not in our century, but in the last 100 years, who would epitomize this idea of being the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon had nothing to do with society. He just had a few students. No one ever saw him. And yet his renown was worldwide, even amongst the Gentiles. He was locked up in a room, pulled down the shade. Even by day, he didn't want any distractions whatsoever. Even by day, he learned by a light, by a candlelight, because he didn't want distractions. And he slept a period of about, altogether, maybe 2.5 hours a day. In fact, they say when his sister came to visit him, hadn't seen his sister for many years. So for him to get up from his studies was like, you have to imagine, like the most painful thing, because he was involved in this great, great happiness, this great joy. So he went outside and he spoke to his sister a little bit, out of, you know, kavod and respect, and then he will have to excuse me, I have to get back. I have to get back to my learning, and that was the end of that. They even said, I remember reading a story in one of the biographies, that they went to the, he didn't spend much time with his wife, obviously, and they said that you know, you should go to him and ask him for a divorce, because he's a great man. He wouldn't refuse to give you a divorce, knowing that the situation being that he doesn't spend much time. So she said no. She knows that he would, but she's very content that he's very happy because marriage is never gone. It's a great benefit. The fact that man is a social animal, listen very carefully, I just put up an idea. David brought the point. So David is right, but man's a social animal. Man is a social animal. I would say like this. Man is an animal. The definition of man is that man is a unique being who has two components. There's the instinctual component, the animalistic, and the telemelic. Now, from whence this idea of being a social animal From whence? What part does that come from? From the instinctual or from the metaphysical? From the instinctual. But man can fashion himself as a, in the, you know, as a metaphysical personality. Insofar as he fashions himself as a metaphysical personality, so his essence is meant to be a social animal. His essence then becomes to be alone. The more, you see what I'm saying? It's not, you'll say like this, if man, it's his nature to be a social animal, so then to be alone he's going to be unhappy because he's not fulfilling his nature. I'm saying that's not his true nature. That stems from his instinctual. His true nature is his tselem Elokim. To the extent that he lives in accordance with his tselem Elokim, and he becomes more of a metaphysical personality, so his whole need of the social becomes less and less and less. Of course, it's relative. It doesn't mean to say he has no need whatsoever. This depends on, yes, Moshe Rabbeinu reached, he was the only individual who separated from his wife. That's the point. His nature was such that it demanded that he be totally and completely always involved in the presence of the, he's the only one. That was the question of Miriam and Aaron. They said he's wrong. That man is a social animal. So it's true he reaches a high madrega, a high level of being close to God, but he can't cut himself off from the social completely. It's impossible. He thought they were wrong. They were right for everybody else except for Moshe Rabbeinu. You see that a person can reach the level of losing that element of his personality where he no longer is a social animal. Now, you see this also in the case of Yaakov. Yaakov was in the Mitzrayim for 17 years. Towards the end of his life, Yosef brings the grandchildren to see him. What did he say? Mi'ela, who are they? It means he didn't even recognize his own grandchildren. He obviously wasn't the typical grandfather. Didn't spend too much time hanging around with his grandchildren. But more than that, you see later on, after Yaakov died, the brothers were afraid that Yosef would take revenge. He's not over there. So they concocted the story that Yaakov had had said that you shouldn't take revenge and so forth. But what caused them? What caused them to, what did Yosef do to cause them to imagine after 17 years they take revenge? He stopped coming to see them. He stopped coming by. He stopped socializing. That bothered them. What does it say? By you, Achay Yosef, he made that VM. The brothers of Yosef saw that their father died. And they said, perhaps Yosef will hate us and return upon us the evil that we did to him. So Rashi says, what did they see? They saw in the death of Yaakov that Yosef used to eat with them on the same table. He used to take his meals with them. And he used to be close and friendly with them. And then when Yaakov died, he ceased to hang around. He stopped hanging out with them. So they took it to mean that he wasn't really sincere. He was only acting friendly to them because of Yaakov. Now that Yaakov is here, his real emotions are coming out. That's not true. What was the truth? The truth was that Yosef really never wanted to hang out. He never wanted to socialize. He only did so to keep it up because it was a mitzvah. So once his father was gone, so there was no mitzvah, so he had no desire to hang out with them. It wasn't hostile. They misunderstood it. He didn't realize apparently that they'd take it that way. The point is why? Because he was on a different metaphysical plane. And when a person's on a different metaphysical plane, so he doesn't enjoy the social camaraderie. It's not the same thing. He can relate, by the way. It doesn't mean he could relate to people. He could relate to people who are on the same metaphysical plane and appeal intellectual, you know, to the intellectual. But just for the sake of the social, he doesn't enjoy it. He has no need for it. In fact, it's a distraction. So, now, let me see if we can answer the question. So now you see that the name Gershom has a tremendous significance. Tremendous significance. What does it mean? It means that this is the greatness that God created a being who has the capacity to, of all the creatures, to appreciate, to live in the world of God, to live in the world of true reality. If only he abandons the world of the false reality. If he becomes a ger. That by becoming a ger, by abandoning the world of the false reality, of the social reality, and directing all of his energy to the world of the true reality, so that he can experience the greatest possible good. Which is to say, a relationship with God which is based upon appreciation of the Chachmas Hashem. That, now, which name should come first? Gershom or Eliezer? Why does the Torah repeat? Why does the Torah repeat both names later on? It repeats both. I'll tell you why. Because both names are two sides of one coin. Moshe named his children to reflect the concept of God's relationship to man, or man's relationship to God. And man relates to God in two ways. One way he relates to God has nothing to do with miracles. Well, or you might call it the greatest miracle. The universe is the greatest miracle of all. He sees the chachma of God all around him. That's the greatest. The fact that he can, wherever he goes and everything that he studies, he sees evidence of God. He sees the chachma of Hashem. And because of this, he can have a relationship and get closer and closer to God. That was more wondrous to Moshe Rabbeinu than the fact that God does something personal for him. It's only compared what God does for me. That's a miracle. The fact that things grow, the fact that he's living in a world which is filled with tremendous chachma, and Hashemayim Asapis Volkeh, he ignores. That's meaningless to him. But to Avraham Avinu, it's just the opposite. The true good is not that God does something to me. That really was irrelevant to him. The true good is the fact that I exist and I'm given the capacity to appreciate all the chachma that's around me, that I can see the hand of God in the universe. That's the true good. That's the most important thing of all. In fact, you see in the benching, in Birkas HaMazon, you ate, most people think, well, you know, thank you for the food you gave me. You know, it's like a personal kind of thing. You don't mention any of the food. Hazanus Olam Kulo, who feeds the entire world. Who knows him like a Lachol Basar? He grants food to all beings. Why are we saying these things? That doesn't sound grateful. Well, you should be grateful for God to see you. What do you mention by saying he does it for everybody? In fact, if you were to, somebody did you a favor, and you were to say, well, that person does it for everybody, not just for me, that would sound like you're being ungrateful. So why are we saying God does it for everybody? The answer is because in Birkas HaMazon, it's not that you're thanking God what God did for you. Of God is not in the fact that I benefited. I benefit because of the fact that there's a whole system behind which there's this being of infinite wisdom. So as far as Moshe was concerned, that was the more important concept of the two. The recognition of God as the Borei Olam. Even if he didn't do anything for me personally, he already did something for me personally by virtue of the fact that he created a whole system of which I'm a part. And I can recognize God from that system. That's Gershom. Eliezer represents the next aspect. Not only does God enable me, not only has God given me everything I need, he enables me to perceive, but God actually intervenes through a separate mechanism, through the Hashkacha Pratis, and saves the tzaddik, and saves an individual, and gets involved in this particular case. That's another aspect of God, another aspect of God's relationship to man. So, therefore, that too must be said. It's also in Birkas. That's the second idea. But the first idea is recognition of God as the Creator. First we have to look at the Zimmer. First we have to recognize God as the Creator of heaven and earth. And the one who's responsible for all of the wonders that we perceive in the world of nature around us. Then we go for the particular. Of the two, you see, the one that was most wondrous to Moshe Rabbeinu was the experience of Gershom. To be a Ger, to be a stranger in a foreign land, that was the greatest experience of his life. And this will help you, the Lord says it, this explains why when he saw the phenomenon of the burning bush, what attracted his attention. He was involved in the study of nature. He saw something different. Mazuolo Yivrashna, he had to know why, he had to know the reason. But also you will see, and we'll take this up at a different time, this will give you an introduction to the seven days of Moshe, the 7 days of Sinai, where he debated with God and was so stubborn, refused to accept submission, which anybody else, can you imagine today, the leaders we have today, if God were to call upon them to lead the Jews, can you imagine refusing? Please send somebody else. Begging God to know somebody else. I can't think of one leader today that would take that attitude. His reluctance to go back. He didn't want to go back from a state of being a ger, of being alone, of being a stranger. Even once a person experiences the greatness of being alone, which means alone, he's not alone. There's no such thing as loneliness. He's with God, involved in enjoying all those ideas and not being distracted. He didn't want to get back into the world of people and politics and not just distraction, but he realized the tremendous pitfall that it has and the corruption that a person could be subjected to. So, I pointed out last week in the reunion. In the reunion between Yisro brought Tzipporah, the two sons. The whole emphasis over there is between who? Between Moshe and Yisro. So he bowed down to him, and he kissed him, and they're talking. There's no mention whatsoever of the reunion with Tzipporah. So that was a completely different kind of thing. So I think, what do we gain? You know, what do we gain from this? That our whole attitude should change. In other words, to a certain extent, if you want to be perfected, you want to perfect yourself, to a certain extent, you've got to be able to be a Ger B'Eretz Nachriyah. Everybody on his own level. You see, we try to extract from the Torah certain ideals. Now, we study them in a form, on a level, which we can't duplicate. We can't duplicate. Yeah, but the Torah is teaching it to us. That means that we can partake of it to a certain extent. Now, in order for a person to achieve anything worthwhile, he has to be capable of withdrawing himself from the social, from society. And certainly at certain important periods in his life. Now, you see the lifestyle of, not the rich and the famous, but the lifestyle of the Gedolim, they always followed this pattern. In their early years, they were totally locked up in the base measure. And we should respect that. Today, people have a negative idea. What do you mean you're just going to sit and learn for a number of years? What's he going to do? They think they look down upon it. They don't recognize the importance of seclusion. And the Rambam, for example, in his early years, was enabled to have a situation where he learned day and night. They didn't have to worry about any responsibility. In the later life, just like Moshe Rabbeinu, then they have to go back to the people and devote themselves to the Yom. They have to devote themselves. In fact, the latter part of the Rambam's life was only for Klal Yisrael. Everything he did, being a doctor, and you see the whole kibbutz could depend upon one man. His position with the Sultan enabled him to have a great one thing, to have great influence. Now the thing is, you have to use your sechel. Now, if any one of us who tried to become like a Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, because if you try and undertake something you're not capable of, you're going to fall apart. On the other hand, you should recognize that if you're totally involved in the social, then it's going to really hamper your ability to grow intellectually. I think it's also important in the stress that we utilize in raising children. Raikita just mentioned recently on a Sunday morning, and that the emphasis in outside today is on social skills. Everything is social. That's why kids have to go to these little programs, or all these different programs when they're 2 or 3 year olds. The whole emphasis is on their ability to socialize. And if somebody has, and very often people have had the idea of starting our own school. You know, we can teach according to, you know, correct principles and so on and so forth. Have a greater control over the curriculum. And then, inevitably, people, well, what about the social? There'll only be about 4 or 5 kids. They won't learn social skills. They won't write. There's tremendous anxiety about social skills. The person who has the social skills, they're dead. And then they place that as being more important than knowledge and learning, than the ideas. They get it from parents, too. They pick it up from parents. Because parents communicate to them that tremendous importance of the social reality. Every kid picks it up in the house. Because they notice the discrepancy. Parents act differently amongst themselves, amongst family, and then when they have company, yes, they'll act differently. They'll put on their best face. Or if something, you know, if the kid misbehaves, something which would be tolerated generally, but if there's company, then they get their, you know, you're going to give it a bad name in the eyes of these other people. It's that type of thing, the social. And the other idea, for kids, I've never mentioned names. There's a guy in the yeshiva, top guy. And years ago, he was really immersed in learning. came to, you know, he was in high school, he wasn't interested, but he came to yeshiva, and he liked the derech, he got immersed in learning. And I'd meet his parents from time to time, and they complained. They'd say, yeah, they like the fact that they were thrilled that he's learning, but he never goes out, even with friends on a Saturday night. He's always either learning, or he's reading a book, or, you know, working on some idea. And it's just not normal. I mean, he should have a date, he should go out with friends, he should have a social life. They were going, they were very, very upset. And these are people that value learning. Now, in my opinion, they're missing out on something. They don't realize that the ability, that's a tremendous virtue. The fact that he did not have such a need. Now, I'm not talking where it's rooted in some kind of a psychological problem. That's something else, because he's not Moshe Rabbeinu, and he's going to need, and he has the social, you know, there's nothing wrong. He has the social skills, he will find the girl, he will get, all these things are going to happen. So if, we're not talking where it's rooted in some kind of a psychological problem, but where it's rooted in the fact that that was his nature. He really enjoyed, had tremendous enjoyment in thinking and knowledge and learning, and didn't get that much enjoyment from the social. The parents are very upset about that, because that was their value. So we learn from this that we have to really modify our whole attitude towards the role that the social situation plays in our life. Yeah. That, as Lori says, by far, putting him into the social situation teaches a very, very dangerous negative idea that the most important thing is the acceptance of your peers. And a child that's, any child that's raised with that idea embedded in them, the acceptance of your social is the most important thing, is virtually finished. We'll never be able to think for himself. Because every idea that he has, he can't have an independent idea. If that idea is unpopular, he's not going to be able to accept that idea. You see what I'm saying? He can't tolerate the idea. All great thinkers discovered new ideas, had to be able to put up with the rejection of their own contemporaries.
Yeah. You're talking about detaching yourself from the
conventional
society, that you have the freedom to come to decide
with your inner principles, what's right. Exactly, 100%.
That's
what I'm talking about. Very well put. You know, the function of this, you see, the implementation would be someone who's a gear of a tosha, who can mingle physically with others, be friendly with them, but not be, but inwardly live in a totally different world. In the world of ideas, he's a gear. But he's capable of interacting. We're not producing a gear of a tosha in America. We are producing a tosha. In other words, another version. The Jew today in America is just another version of an American.
But in terms of personal
possession, who was the highest level of mankind in reach. So we're talking, when you're talking about the perfection of Moshe, you're talking about something. Moshe's in a class by himself. And Avraham Avinu is talking as a different, in other words, for one who will always be part of the social thing, then Gervatosha.
I have a question. Yeah, but even Moshe was on the class.
Yeah, that's a practical. I just use that.
That's it.
The thing is, it depends what motivates you to be a tosha. If your motivation is because of a weakness and a need for acceptance, then it's a problem. If the motivation is your objective realization, it's a rational kind of thing, like Avraham Avinu, then that's good, then it's a virtue. Moshe said all these things. Moshe recognized, Moshe assumed that to be the leader, he had to have certain of these social qualities, which he didn't possess. Well, we'll take that up when we get into that area. He argued with God. God nevertheless chose him as being the most worthy. So, that's a different thing.
Somebody like who was really able to partake of the political as well.
Yeah, but you have to realize it's true. But Moshe's leadership was of a different kind.
But
it's only Moshe to do.
Yeah, but not going to be a person like
Shlomo. Like, the Melech HaMashiach will be a very charismatic individual.
And he'll be
there because he will, Rachov, he'll bring all the Jewish people back to the observance of Torah. He'll be a communicator of the highest magistrate.
Yeah,
and his son were in the cave for 13 years. And when they came out, they couldn't understand why people would waste their time tilling the soil. Meaning to say that they had just, for them, that was the greatest possible experience. Once they had a taste of that, the enjoyment of that isolation, they could understand the rest of the world. But then, of course, God told them not, you know, it's dangerous. Because once people hear about this, they'll stop, you won't have a world. Yeah.